Hi, this is Eric Anderson. I'm a troubadour and a singer-songwriter, and I'm very happy to be invited to Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio. That's University of Northern Colorado. And I'm very happy to be talking to Saul Solomon, who's our host for the day. Thank you.
Oh, shalom, my friends, my neighbors, my listeners. Welcome again to the Dave's Gone By radio program of the air. This is me, Rabbi Saul Solomon, theater lover, art lover, culture lover, and even more than anything, music lover, lover of the folk and also the folk pop realm, going all the way back to the 1960s, especially with people like Tom Paxton and Judy Collins and Joan Baez and the person that we have here on the telephone with us right now. I would like to call him Ari Anderstein, because that makes me feel more Jewish about him, even though he's not. He is, however, and has been a troubadour for decades. He's written the songs Thirsty Boots and Merry Sunshine, Time Run Like a Freight Train, Violets of Dawn, such a pretty song. He's even the winner of the biggest possible prize that the Italians can give out, the Premio Tenco. And you know, if the Italians don't hang you from the train station, they give you a big prize, their highest songwriting award. And most importantly, perhaps, is that in a recent story about a concert that Eric Anderson gave, in the Albany Daily Gazette, they wrote, Eric Anderson is one of those rare singer-songwriters who seems to only get better with age. God knows nobody's ever going to say that about me, but it's a thrill and a delight to have with us in the neighborhood, Ari Anderstein. Shalom, Ari.
Shalom to you, Rabbi.
Oh, it's a blessing, it's a pleasure. Let me ask you before anything else, how religious / spiritual are you in your life and work?
Well, I think, you know, you have to be spiritual at all times. It's like being on guard, you know.
On guard against the bad things, the...
Well, the anti-spiritual things.
Okay. Have you always been a centered kind of Zen-like person?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to be... You can't get too attached to things because this business can be very disappointing.
Yeah, we will get into that. You have had some pretty bitter disappointments, but you have seemed to have an optimistic way of coping with them. And we will certainly get into the career here of this very fine singer-songwriter. But first of all, also, Mazel Tov, like a year ago or so, you turned 70 years old. How do you feel?
Well, I feel pretty good. I mean, I'm very blessed because a lot of my contemporaries have encountered problems, and my friend Lou Reed died last year.
But were you close-ish friends? I know you collaborated on some music together.
Yeah, we were close friends.
So what was he like? Because you'll hear such bifurcated things about Lou Reed. I've talked to other journalists who, even after he died, they couldn't find a good thing to say about him. And then there are other people who loved him. What are your memories and thoughts?
I feel very good. You know, I feel my health is quite good.
No, but about Lou Reed, I meant.
We're talking about my health or how I was feeling. And, you know, I'm doing what I want to do. And that, of course, helps your longevity if you're doing what you want. So I do my writing and I do my performing and I travel and I'm quite blessed and lucky to be able to do this.
Well, yes, and lucky to have you. But I did also want to, since you mentioned him, do you have any cute, fun, nice anecdotes about your friendship with Lou Reed?
Well, Lou, you know, I mean, he's one of these geniuses types. You know, he couldn't truck or he couldn't handle fools very well.
Well, neither can I, but that's just me.
He made a huge contribution, and I think everybody was really amazed and shocked and overwhelmed how much the impact of his death, you know, it was like everywhere in the world. I mean, even the front page of the Moscow newspapers.
Right, and also certainly New York felt like it lost.
It affected a lot of people, you know, I mean, it was everywhere, and even the New York Times ran 10 videos of this stuff. It was a big loss, I think, for the music world.
Do you have a favorite all-time Lou Reed song?
I like a lot of his stuff. His writing, you know, liberated a lot of people, and liberation ain't bad.
Very nicely put. So what was it like writing with him? Who would do, what, was it a pure collaboration? Would you come with lyrics? Would he, how do you...
I
go
with lyrics, and then he looked them over. He changed some things. We went into a studio with no clue what to do in terms of recording, and we just sat there, And he tried to come up with some kind of his idea of a folky melody, which was a total disaster.
Okay.
And then I started playing. He had this beautiful Collins guitar, and I just asked if I could play it. And they said nothing, apropos to nothing. They said nothing to do with our job at hand was to go in and record something, though we didn't have any music for the song. And I just started playing something like Mystery Train, some old Elvis rockabilly tune. And out of that came, we got this kind of groove, and it seemed to fit the lyrics. And we wrote the tune, figured it out in about, 10 minutes, and went and recorded it.
Wow. Now, how does that experience compare to when you were writing songs with Townes Van Zandt?
Well, Townes would come up with some lyrics, or we would sit, come up with lyrics together, funny things or things that came to mind. I remember he was laying on the bed in my apartment, and I was at the table with, it was kind of like a couch doubled as a bed for guests. It was a small place in Manhattan on 21st Street. And I sat with a guitar and I was working out music. We were trying to work out music and lyrics at the same time. And it was very smooth, very easy.
And did you have a sense that he would not live a very long life?
No.
So back then, you could have assumed that he would have lived as long, 70, 80 years old back then.
Well, I think when you're very young, you think you're immortal. Mm-hmm. Nobody's thinking about death. I mean, I'm not saying that all people don't. Of course,
right.
You've got people like Albert Camus who did, and you had people like Rimbaud who did. You had poets and, of course, burgeoning philosophers. They were probably thinking of that question. Of course, you think about it when you're talking about Civil War, civil rights and the Vietnam War. That was during my time. There was death, but how real was it? When you're 20 years old, the impact isn't quite the same as when you know a lot of people around you, like Townes or Lou, people who die.
Oh, I see.
Hmm. Things get a little closer to home.
So let's roll it back. Let's take it back. You born living in Pittsburgh, then you moved to Buffalo with your family. How did you get from Buffalo to the poet scene and the music and the folk scene where in the 1960s suddenly you're in New York and part of that whole group?
I left school. It's a lot of this is you can read about too. It's pretty, public. But after I went to college for a couple of years, I was on a pre-med program and I was very interested in writing and music in particular. And after 2 years, I left and I went to California to meet the Beats. I was very interested in. I was always interested in writers who were, liberated minds, liberated minds or souls or spirits, if you will.
Well, when you were young, did you feel that you were sort of constrained and you needed that liberation, or were you raised in a way that was free?
I was raised in a very normal neighborhood. I knew some of the alt type heads in school and high school. That were interested in books and reading, and my father was interested in poetry, so I started reading things like, kind of heavy stuff like Russian literature and Dostoevsky, Rimbaud. Then I got exposed to the Beats, and I got very interested in the writings, especially, Kerouac, and it's a typical story.
Well, yes.
And then later I went on to California, and I met these people, and I actually composed a long recitative, a 26-minute spoken piece called Beat Avenue, recounting the night I was with Allen Ginsberg, the night John Kennedy got killed in San Francisco. He didn't get killed there, of course. He got killed in Dallas, but I went to a reading and a party afterwards with Ginsberg, David Meltzer, a poet, Neil Cassidy, who's a protagonist of On the Road,
right.
Writer. Michael McClure and a whole bunch of people. It wasn't like a huge party. It was up at Farrell and Getty's house. And I just was invited to tag along, and it was quite a remarkable night. So I wrote this long piece. It's called Beat Avenue. It's I don't know if you heard it, but it's out there.
It's on. Didn't you put it on one of your albums as a kind of a?
Well, it's an album called Beat Avenue. It's a
right.
CD.
So, any memories though of Ginsberg and that crowd beyond that particular night?
Well, I'd see Alan would come. He'd come drop by gigs once in a while. I'd see him from time to time. Go to his house. I met Corso later on. Hung out with him a little bit. And William, I only met. Alan called me up to go to a symposium. He was talking a symposium, course, on the beach, and Burroughs was there for one of them, and Michael McClure was there, and he was still running classes at the same time. You know, we were sitting around while he was trying to get the papers in from the students. You know, it was almost like Blackboard Jungle. What do you mean, teach? I don't have to write a paper. They were very rude to him. And later, then people walked up and said hello to William Burroughs and Michael McClure. And F. Murray Abraham kindly gave me an old edition of, he lived in the neighborhood. He gave me an edition of Naked Lunch, and I got them to sign it for me. That was quite memorable.
Wow. And you actually did something more recently about Naked Lunch. Didn't you contribute an essay somewhere about that?
No, I did an essay for Naked Lunch, the 50th anniversary essays. Naked Lunch at 50, published by University of Southern Illinois Press.
What did that book by William Burroughs mean to you? I mean, it was also part of that
Burroughs was a very liberating writer. He was very much against authority, you know. He was very much against oppression. So any kind of writers are against oppression or repression, that kind of the individual, those are my people.
So how did you go from being sort of in the beat and poetry writing mode more into the 2-3-4 minute folk song mode?
I don't know.
Ha! Okay.
I don't know the answer. Songwriting is kind of a simple thing in a way. It's like it's verses and choruses. So I did my best to try to break the boundaries of this, and I wrote long pieces like Ghosts Upon the Road, Beat Avenue, Memory of the Future, things were more involved than just short rhyming pieces, you know.
And also to become part of, and you gravitated to the New York crowd, and we have had on this radio program Tom Paxton a few years ago, wonderful, great songwriter, a great American legend songwriter. So is it true that he was kind of the main mentor for you in that scene?
Yeah, he in one way, him and Phil Oakes were the two mentors. By the way, I've been working a lot of kind of outside of the regular folk music business lately. I'm doing a thing in Tangier. It's Burroughs' 100th birthday this year.
Oh, in Tangier.
He wrote Naked Lunch. So the European Beach Studies Network, it's a new organization. It's been out for, they've been working in business for 3 years, and they've had conferences in south of Holland and Copenhagen, and now it's in Tangier. So I'm going to be performing Beat Avenue there.
Oh, nice.
A lot with Albert Camus. For a painter who does a lot of portraits, a German painter. They're doing a show at the Bon Art Museum, and I wrote the poetry and the songs. They're going to include a CD, so I've been working on that for about 2 years.
And also, we should mention that you do apparently have a new CD that's going to be coming out this year. It's called, Dance of Love and Death? When is that due?
We don't know. We don't have a label for it yet.
Oh.
Very hard to get a label.
Okay. Okay, so you're no longer with Appleseed.
It has nothing to do with the music. It has to do with everybody's idea of what music should be.
Well, in this day and age, it's a fair question. Do you need a label? Can't you just be...
No. I mean, there's no record stores anymore. There's no place... You can only... I think Jeff Bezos controls everything. And between them and iTunes, they have what's left.
Right.
The empty carcasses of closed bookstores and, the bones of record stores. They can't even sell DVDs, Then when the record stores went down, they tried to augment it by selling DVDs, to take up half the space and sell movies. And that didn't work either.
Well, because now everything is digital, movies too. You order it on your TV.
Netflix, that's it.
Right, but have you, then, what is the new business model? Is it simply printing your own and selling them at concerts?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't think there is a business model.
Well, you get to eat, you get to live. You're getting some kind of revenue stream from, how do you make your living, Eric Anderson?
Well, I do what everybody else does. You work, you perform. I mean, people have to perform more because there's no royalties anymore, very few. Like Bon Jovi, for example, Netflix has a stockholder-owned business.
Okay.
That rents music, like Pandora. They rent the music out. You can't actually download it, but you can pay every month so much money and get it for uninterrupted, no advertising,
Right. Sounds like Spotify, too, yeah?
record companies make flat deals. They did the best they could to grab money for themselves. But Bon Jovi, I think he said, you know, that they had something like 19 million hits, and he got $19.
Oh. Hmm.
From Spotify. So, I mean, there's no money anymore. There's nothing in there. It's just robbery. No money for the artists, nothing for the writers anymore. ASCAP just lost a case. So everybody's screwed in terms of, you know, there may not be any art, and, you know, if it's commercialized, it's going to be run into the ground.
Although people have been complaining about the way artists have been screwed all the way back to the Medici era. You know, and you, let's face it, you were kind of screwed by a major label, by the most major of all, by Columbia.
This is like wholesale destruction, you know. It's not an individual and it's Columbia. It's like this is happening to, you know, artists don't receive payment for all the plays they get for these new media outlets.
Or at least they're going to figure out how they would have come up with a new business model. They haven't yet. They're still trying to shake it out and figure out.
Yeah, my record companies were really, you know, tearing their hair out. They didn't know what to do. They're just grasping for the straws.
Well, do you get royalties at least from the albums that you did 20, 30, 40 years ago?
Well, not really, because they're not available. They're not for sale. Listen, Bob Dylan recorded one of my songs. You know, we're trying to figure out if we're going to get any money for that.
Oh, did he do it on that self-portrait second?
Yeah.
Right. Well, of course
we're
you should.
We're all joking. Well, when Bob's money comes in, we'll get our, you know, ourselves a condo somewhere. Rio.
Hey, look, you know, hopefully.
I mean, you don't know anymore what's going to happen.
Now, you, speaking of Bob Dylan, I've got to ask this because everybody's always going to be fascinated with the 73-year-old Bob Dylan. You were on, briefly, the Rolling Thunder tour. Do you have any memories of him or of that?
I did a thing in Niagara Falls with him, and I did a thing the very first night, so I wasn't really around the whole tour, but I was in a couple things. Yeah, it was just a wonderful, wonderful evening. It's very exciting. Music. A lot of music. And a lot of fun, a lot of parties.
I'm sure it was pretty nuts. There was also a concert that you did, or a tour, that was on a train with a bunch of people. And that was kind of insane. That wasn't Rolling Thunder. That was earlier.
The Festival Express, the greatest rock and roll party that ever happened in the world. On wheels.
Well, what made it such a wonderful party?
Well, listen, we had the train to ourselves, just for the performers and the bands. And any train that had a car, a doctor's car with seven doctors, that'll give you some idea.
Well, you know, that's also a fair question for you, Eric Anderson. Since you were around in all that part of it, it was sex, drugs, and if not rock and roll, folk rock. How did you ever have a real problem with substances?
No.
Because you were just not drawn to it, or you did enough, but you didn't get addicted?
Wrote a song called Sheila, you know, and people thought I was a junkie, which was not true.
So how did you avoid going into what happened to Janis Joplin, who you knew, and to some of these other people?
Well, when you have kids and you can't afford it, that's one way to avoid it.
Okay, that makes sense. Since I mentioned Janis Joplin, what was she like privately? I think you last saw her before she recorded Mercedes-Benz, right?
She was very sweet and very, very, very intelligent, very kind. And she didn't suffer fools either. She was a little like Lou.
Hmm.
Maybe a little nicer.
I, from what I hear, most people are generally nicer than Lou. And speaking of people who are sort of inscrutable, I didn't even realize, but Wikipedia mentions that you were in and starred in an Andy Warhol movie.
Right.
What was it like being at the factory?
Yeah, a movie called Space.
Okay.
It's been shown at museums. I mean, you can't get Warhol films are not available. You can't buy them. You can't buy DVDs or videos of them. They're tightly controlled. So these things are only shown at festivals and museums and places like that.
Okay, but what are your memories of doing the movie, of being at the factory?
It was a very silly movie because the person who wrote the script walked out after 5 minutes because nobody followed it.
Oh, well.
He went into the elevator, went down, and he was never seen or heard from again.
Okay. Did you notice, I mean, did it really seem like a factory there? Were there people just in one corner making paintings other places?
It was absolutely, Warhol did a lot of paintings, there was a lot of stuff on the floor, a lot of stuff leaned against the wall. Billy Name, he covered the whole, photographer, he covered the whole, all the walls in foil.
Okay.
It was a really cool place. Everybody hanging up at Warhol was so focused and concentrated, he just kept moving on, you know, whatever he was doing, people didn't bother him. They wouldn't. He's very charismatic that way.
Okay. Now let me ask about your focus and concentration. Did you set aside a part of every day to write or practice, or do you just wait for inspiration, or what's your day like?
I write every day. I'm always writing. I'm working on my novel now, and I've been doing a lot of stuff for Albert Camus for this catalog that's coming out for this painter, and they're releasing it on a vinyl in Europe. I'm making a CD for the catalog and a vinyl for Europe, for, you know, general consumption. And so I'm always writing, all the time.
How do you feel about deadlines? Do they help you? Do you hate them? Do you need them?
Well, I have a lot of deadlines sometimes. I just finished a piece for a friend of mine who brought me to Norway, you know, to Europe for the first time, and they're doing a memorial for him, and I just wrote a piece on him because I was the one who kind of got him started in this getting into the music scene. And in this very little small seaport town, fjord town, Norway, he started this operation where he brought in, like, Chuck Berry, Bob Dylan, the band, Ry Cooder. Mm. I mean, he brought in so many incredible acts to this little place, you know. But I was there, I'm to blame. I'm the one that got him kind of going on his thing. Because he had promoted some shows of mine, and he found out he liked it, and he started this thing. But he was... very sadly, he was murdered.
And oh, wow.
So we're doing a special thing for him in August. So there's a deadline. I just finished that. And then this deadline for this museum, and I've got a deadline for my own book. So there's a lot of, you know, it's a reason to be. It's a raison d'etre to keep going. Writing is, you know, like Burroughs says, I agree, you got to write your way out of it.
Oh, well. Let me ask you, we have a couple more minutes, just a couple, with Erik Anderson here. But Norway looms large in your life. Your family ancestry background goes back there?
Yeah, on my father's side, yeah, but they all emigrated. So my father was actually born in America, but he went back to the old family house. They had a very old, large house that he went and saw where his mother was born, you know. And they still live there. It's been there for 1783. The family's still there.
Well, but you chose, at a certain point, many years ago, to go live in Norway.
Yeah, I met somebody there, and, you know, I liked it. It was nice to get out of America for a while. Always back and forth, commuting, doing stuff, so I never felt... I was sort of straddling the pond, you know, as it were.
And now, do you still, or are you on the West... Where are you these days... Mostly.
I'm outside of Amsterdam now, and I come to New York from time to time, do work.
Cool. And is your wife, Inga, who is also a singer-songwriter, she has an album that you helped work on about 2 years ago.
She made an album that got a great review and no depression, but she's a scientist, so she doesn't really tour much.
She's a scientist? Oh, my goodness.
She's a research scientist.
How did you meet her?
In Switzerland.
Oh, Switzerland, that guy's show. She came to one of your shows.
Yeah, and we talked and we met, you know, we hung out a little bit, and the rest is history.
And you have 4 kids, is that right, together?
Well, you know, I got enough. I got plenty of another interview, so. But anyway, thank you so much for calling.
Well, thank you. It's been very, very charming talking to you, Erik Anderson. Much success with all your projects, with the Camus, with the new record, with everything that you're doing, and much more good health and years ahead.
Thank you very much.
Shalom.